Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Hi there. Before we start the show, I got to tell you about Omaha Steaks. They have a limited time Father's Day offer that your dad is going to love, love, love. When you go to omahasteaks.com, enter the code LIBERAL in the search bar and save 55%. For $79.99, your summer sizzle pack for dad will include the following: 4 natural lean top sirloin steaks, hand-carved and aged 21 days for tenderness and flavor, 4 boneless chicken breasts, 4 gourmet jumbo Franks and kielbasa sausages, a package of all-beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 caramel apple tartlets, and an Omaha Steaks signature seasoning packet. Dad's going to get all this delicious food, plus a free pound of steak-cut bacon. This amazing gift is ready to be shipped straight to Dad's door in time for Father's Day for just $79.99. These packages come flash-frozen, vacuum-sealed, and delivered in a cooler with dry ice safely to his door. All backed by Omaha Steaks' unconditional 100% money-back guarantee and the best customer service anywhere. It's a simple, delicious way to treat Dad this Father's Day. So don't wait. Go to omahasteaks.com and type the code LIBERAL in the search bar to order the summer sizzle pack for Father's Day right now. That's omahasteaks.com and type LIBERAL in the search bar. And now let the cartoons begin.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Zeska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, June 17, 2020, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Zeska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. You might know my guest from the Rachel Maddow Show, and specifically the accompanying Maddow blog website. I'm talking, of course, about the great Steve Bannon. Steve's also the author of the brand new book out now, The Imposters: How Republicans Quit Governing and Seized American Politics. Link in the description at bobzeska.com. You know, I've been a reader of Steve's work going all the way back to Blogosphere 1.0 when he wrote for Washington Monthly. So I can't wait to ask him about a gazillion different things today. Oh, by the way, if you like what you hear, please help support this show by subscribing to our bonus content at bobzeskashow.com. Okay, let's talk with the great Steve Bannon from Maddow Blog. Tell me about your book. Let's start off there. Tell me about The Imposters, which was officially released yesterday, right?
Correct, yes. So the book is about the Republican Party over the last decade or so, making the transition away from being a governing party. And what it's become, in my argument, is that it's become what I call a post-policy party.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean it is a party that has become indifferent to the substance of policymaking. That it's against expertise and analysis, it's hostile toward evidence, and it's indifferent to how ideas are supposed to be crafted and scrutinized and implemented.
Yeah.
And I think as a result of that, we're dealing with a political crisis that's driven by that identical, that exact problem.
You know, and it's such an outstanding topic for a book, given how Trump, a guy without any core values whatsoever, has basically just hijacked the Republican Party, borrowing bits and pieces from Roger Ailes, Alex Jones, even. I mean, did you ever think, covering Alex Jones years ago, that eventually we'd kind of have the Alex Jones presidency, more or less? And it's, of course, it's all filtered through Trump's sociopathy and cruel whimsy. Is that what you're observing as well in the book?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the arguments that I make is that the problem did not start exclusively with Trump. That, and to my mind, the problem really started at the end of the Bush-Cheney era, when Republicans basically found themselves at a crossroads. Their party had been, their agenda had been rejected by voters, and Bush-Cheney had failed so spectacularly. It was up to the party and its leaders to basically come up with a new agenda and a new what would its priorities be? What would its policies be? Mm-hmm. And what I think they decided at the time, what Republicans decided at the time, is that they weren't going to have an agenda at all. They were just going to be they were to define themselves by their opposition to whatever Barack Obama was for. And so what we saw for 8 years was a party that had effectively given up on taking governing seriously at all. And then to my mind, the argument that I make in the book is that helped pave the way for Trump, who, of course, as you just noted, has no use for ideas or substance of governing at all.
Yeah.
And so it's really, to me, we had a problem throughout the Obama era with Republicans who didn't care. And then now we see that problem on steroids with a president who really doesn't care.
Yeah, right, right. Where do you think that came from? What was the spark that triggered this movement away from policy and into just winning at all costs, owning the libs? It seems like it may have been kind of prompted by the fact that Barack Obama was more or less untouchable. I mean, they really couldn't find anything that stuck to the wall with Barack Obama. There weren't any personal scandals. There wasn't anything salacious in his background. So it seemed like throughout that 8 year span, they really struggled to find something. So in absence of actually latching on to anything, did they just start making shit up? Is that kind of how it started?
Well, you know, in part, I think that the issue for me, and when I look back at that era and when I analyze it in the book, I think that Republicans made it a conscious choice that to cooperate with Democrats, to work constructively on anything with a Democratic White House would somehow be against, it would hurt Republicans electorally. It would give them a disadvantage.
Yeah.
You know, Mitch McConnell had a series of quotes in which he basically was confessing to the fact that any kind of cooperation, any kind of bipartisan constructive policymaking would be seen by voters as a success. And they wanted to deny Obama and Democrats successes. Mm-hmm. So they said no to literally everything. Even when Obama would agree with them, they would then change their minds and say that they were against what they used to be for.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, that became so problematic that government simply didn't work. I mean, we have a Madisonian model of government, and it caused this crisis where Democrats would work on solutions and they would say they didn't care what worked and what those solutions entailed. And so That helps, I think, pave the way for someone like Trump, who has no background in government, no background in public service, no real interest in how government works or how policies are formed or how they are implemented. And you couple that with an ideological hostility on the right to government working at all, and it kind of creates this toxic stew.
Would the notion of the imposters exist at all without such a hefty propaganda wing, without Fox News Channel, AM talk radio? Would that have functioned? Because it seemed to me as if it'd be really difficult to get the fiction to resonate without that, right? It seems like Roger Ailes had a gigantic part to play in this.
You know, one of the points, it's such an important point, Bob, and I'm glad you raised that, because I think that one of the things that I make, one of the arguments that I present in the book, is that there's an importance on incentives. Now, if Republicans didn't have an incentive to just abandon their governing responsibilities, if they didn't have an incentive, they'd behave differently. Mm-hmm. If they were rewarded for good behavior instead of bad behavior, then their actions would change, their behaviors would change, the way they conduct themselves would change. Mm-hmm. And so I think that conservative media has played a major role in creating this unhealthy set of incentives where Republicans believe that they can get away with abandoning their governing responsibilities, where they feel like they'll actually run the risk of being punished by acting responsibly and engaging in serious policymaking. And so that those incentives guide their behavior in ways that really work to everyone's disadvantage.
And it seems as though the imposters have created a new battleground for the political debate here. I mean, it's gone from left versus right, more or less. I mean, obviously, there are various iterations of that, to basically what we're looking at now, which is reality versus fiction. I mean, how can the fiction side possibly sustain itself in the long run? It just seems like such a rickety, unstable foundation for any sort of long-term movement.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. I mean, one would like to think that in time, if you elect a bunch of people to be in positions of authority and they don't know what to do with that authority and they don't really seem particularly interested in learning, that is untenable dynamic. Like that is a government cannot and would not work under those circumstances. And so, I mean, I think that one of the points I make in the last chapter, and I talked a little bit about looking ahead to how this can be fixed and what, you know, what kind of future we can have with this. The argument that I make, one of the arguments I make is that parties change when voters tell them they have to change. That when you know, we talked a little bit earlier about incentives, you know, so long as they feel like, as long as Republicans believe that they can continue to win elections and ignore their governing responsibilities at the same time, they'll continue to do that. But once they lose, it forces them to reassess it. It forces them to look anew at, okay, well, what is our platform going to be? Can we just recycle the old one again? Well, no. I mean, that, you know, which is what we're seeing, you know, right now with Republicans. And so my hope is that in the event of a Republican defeat in 2020 or 2024 or whenever, it will force the party to look anew at their governing responsibilities. Are they prepared to kind of rework those muscles that have atrophied over the course of the last 12 years?
Yeah.
Will that be enough to kind of spur that change? You know, one of the things I think is worth emphasizing is that, you know, I've disagreed with the Republican agenda for much of my adult life, but I recognize the fact that they used to take governing at least somewhat seriously. I mean, you and I might agree that they're wrong on a lot of issues, but it's not just about being wrong on the issues. It's about how they approach going about dealing with those issues.
Mm-hmm.
What my book tries to emphasize is that it's not enough to just say that Republicans are wrong on the issues. It's how they go about dealing with those issues that is the real problem.
Do you think the winning at all cost model is also driven by worsening demographics for a mostly white only party like the GOP, for lack of a better term? The oncoming browning of America seems like it's terrifying the Republicans, and they can't really wiggle out of that very well on policy alone. So it seems like they're now going for, well, rah, we're the alpha men. We win and we do whatever we have to do to win. Is it the demographics driving that too a little bit?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. And, you know, and on a related note, I think one of the things that those demographic challenges are leading the Republicans to take extra aggressive measures as it relates to voting restrictions.
Yeah. You know,
when they look ahead at a country that's becoming increasingly diverse racially and ethnically, they start to see, well, they could change their policies and become more popular, or they can make it harder for Americans to show up and cast the ballot.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think what we're seeing in recent years is that they're choosing that latter path. One of the things I talk about in the book is that, you know, Republicans are not dumb. It's not a question of intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Republicans are capable of taking their governing responsibilities seriously and analyzing evidence and appreciating the importance of data. We know that for sure because look at how they deal with election data and districts and gerrymandering. You know, they know how to use data when they are rigging elections. They don't know how to use data when they're trying to pass healthcare or immigration or dealing with foreign policy. So I think you're right on the demographics being something that is very much on their minds. I just wish that they would deal with the issue in a more constructive way.
Yeah, right. It seems like while there are some dumb ones, the ones who are very, very smart are actually pretty good at acting dumb. I cite Ted Cruz as an example. I mean, Ted Cruz isn't a dummy. He just plays one on TV, and he's really obvious when he does it, isn't he?
Well, you know, the funny thing about Ted Cruz, and I've made this point online probably, so forgive me if you've seen this, but the point I've made about Ted Cruz is he's not dumb. He thinks everyone else is dumb.
Right.
Because the things that he says, well, you and I know that they're wrong and ridiculous. He knows that they're wrong and ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But he's of the opinion, I think, that voters are so foolish and so easily fooled that he can say these absurd things and get away with it because he has no real respect for the intelligence of the electorate.
Oh, yeah.
And so I mean, of course, there's a range in Republican politics between those who are very bright and those who are not.
Yeah.
But I think the reason I emphasize the idea that Republicans are not dumb is that I don't want to give the impression that the party itself is incapable of governing, because I don't think that's the case. I mm-hmm. think they are capable of governing.
Yeah.
I think they can pursue conservative goals in an intellectually rigorous way, the way the party used to in decades past. I just think that at this point, they're not doing that for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that they've become rather lazy and they don't really have any incentives to change. At least they haven't felt any incentives to change yet.
Yeah, yeah. Seems like they've boxed themselves in with the dumbness, with the dumb act, with the who me business, where, for example, they feel as though in order to appeal to a certain demographic and to get the, you know, like the attacks on academia and intelligentsia and East Coast elite liberals and so on, in order to get those attacks to land, they also have to kind of pander to the dummies. You know, that's kind of how it looks from the outside, especially, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I certainly hear what you're saying. I mean, I think that they have an image in their mind as to who their base is, who mm-hmm. is going to appeal to, who's going to find their message appealing,
yeah.
who's going to show up at their rallies, who's going to donate money to their campaigns. And so, I mean, ideally, a party that hopes to be a governing party would want to expand its reach, have a big tent, appeal to as broad an audience as possible, and expand on that as best they can to win elections. But Republicans are making a gamble in recent years. They decided that they're not going to reach out, they're going to reach in, and they're going to appeal to that base and literally no one else. And the way to do that in their minds and their strategy is to do everything they can to get that base as angry and enraged and engaged as possible. And the result is a politics that's increasingly toxic and which does not work.
You know, and along those lines, would any other Republican have treated the coronavirus the way Trump has? In other words, would say John McCain or even Ted Cruz, going back to a previous example, have turned it into this political hot potato, inspiring their disciples to refuse masks and social distancing rules and all that? Or is this incompetent malevolence purely a feature of Trumpism rather than the broader Republican Party? I mean, any other presidential level leader on the GOP side, would they have precipitated this kind of madness?
That's a great question. I think that, to me, there are two elements of this. This is a coin with two sides. We have the policy and then we have the politics.
Mm-hmm.
And on the policy side, you know, Trump has failed quite spectacularly when it comes to pretty much the entire federal response.
Yeah.
Downplaying the significance of the crisis, mixed messages throughout, failing on everything from personal protective equipment to testing across the board. As a substantive matter, he's failed on every front.
Yeah.
It is easy for me to imagine, because I believe that Republican politics is dominated by this post-policy thinking, it is easy for me to imagine a different Republican, one of Trump's rivals from 2016, for example, and I can imagine them doing nearly as badly as Trump, because I think this attitude is permeating the party where they're not taking governing seriously. So that's the policy front. On the politics front, I think you're really emphasizing an important point that shouldn't be too quickly put aside. I think that Trump is unique on the political front. If Jeb Bush were president right now, hypothetically,
yeah.
If Jeb Bush were president right now, could I imagine him engaging in the kind of political garbage that we hear from Trump on the coronavirus? I think it's unlikely. He might have failed on the policy, but I would be surprised if Jeb Bush or Carly Fiorina or pick your candidate, if any of them would be quite as malicious in the exploitation of the virus for political ends. Do you agree, by the way? Do you think that makes sense?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. In fact, what I'm seeing too here is, does Trump know that beyond his words, that his behavior also resonates? And specifically, I go back to what I mentioned a second ago, which is the masks and social distancing. And
right.
He seems to at least understand on a certain level that his behavior, what he projects on television, again, outside of the crackpot crazy things that he blurts, that even right. just the act of not wearing a mask is going to resonate with his people to the point where now seems like there's this gigantic counterfactual movement to just screw it. We're not wearing masks. We're not going to social distance at all. And in fact, if you tell us that we have to wear a mask, why, that's unconstitutional. And we're going to scream about it on YouTube. Does Trump know that that's what he's doing?
Probably. My best guess is probably.
Right. There's no way to tell for sure, but I mean, it seems like.
Well, right, right. I mean, yeah. I will confess to you, Bob, that I do not know Donald Trump personally. he never returns my calls. He doesn't respond to my emails. I mean, there's a degree of speculation involved in this. But,
yeah.
But you know, I will say, though, that, you know, one of the, to just kind of tie it back to my book for a moment, you know, I think that Trump is an embodiment of this post-policy thesis, insofar as he wants not only his party but his followers to be so antagonistic towards experts and analysis and data.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when the experts and the data and the evidence tell people, you know, don't go to Tulsa into a 19,000 seat theater, which is enclosed around people who you don't know, and stop wearing masks, you know, when the evidence and the data and the experts say that that's a bad idea, he reflexively says, reject those people. Don't trust experts. You know, the eggheads with glasses, they're not to be relied upon. Donald Trump is to be relied upon. And that is very much inconsistent with the thesis of my book, that is post-policy thinking in its embodiment with Donald Trump. And so, you know, I think the mask issue is on the one hand insane because, you know, there's just common sense and we're in the midst of a pandemic, and this shouldn't be too complicated. But Donald Trump is so hostile towards reason, and he demands the same of his followers, that we're stuck in this ridiculous culture war that just it seems so baffling to people like you and me.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, not to necessarily promote a book that's not yours, but Tom Nichols, the Never Trumper Tom Nichols, wrote an amazing book that I think encapsulates a lot of what we're observing right now. It's called The Death of Expertise. And it seems like right. the, I don't want to say necessarily the entire Republican Party, but at least the Trump-infected portion of the Republican Party is attacking experts as much as they're attacking liberals. And it doesn't matter what the politics are of those particular experts. Just if you're an expert, you're going to at some point debunk the fiction that we were talking about, because it is a party that's now more or less based on fiction. And in order to facilitate that, they have to undermine the expertise of the people who know what they're talking about, right?
Yeah. And I'm really glad to hear you say this, because it's so in keeping with my book, with what I was into, with what I'm documenting. You know, I'm just kind of going through in my mind, you know, on healthcare, when Republicans unveiled a plan in 2017, and stakeholders, people like hospital administrators and insurance company executives and the American Medical Association, American Nurses Association, the AARP, all said, this is going to hurt a lot of people and it will not solve any problems. The Republican response was, don't listen to the experts.
Yeah.
Don't listen to the people who know what they're talking about, who've invested their adult lives in these issues. Don't listen to them. And the same is true on things like the Iran deal. You know, the experts told them the Iran nuclear deal was working. It was having exactly the intended effect. Iran was not advancing its nuclear program at all. It was working perfectly. And what was the White House, the Trump White House's response? Don't listen to the experts.
That's right.
We had to prioritize politics over policy. We had to prioritize undoing Obama's agenda as opposed to building our own agenda. And so, right, this is the problem, I think, with American politics right now. Right? We cannot advance policymaking in any real way so long as we have a party that is so allergic to governing.
Is it a waste of time to hector these people about contradicting themselves or calling out their hypocrisy? They don't really care about those two things anymore, do they?
No, I think you're right. I think that I can think of so many instances in recent years in which you and me and people like who are of like mind will point out these hypocrisies and inconsistencies. And in response, what we generally see from Trump and people like him is a shrugging of the shoulders. But the reason I realize that this is controversial to a certain degree, because there's a school of thought that says that the very idea of engaging in that process of pointing it out is pointless. I, I want to disagree.
Yeah, me too.
I think that, and I think that the reason I disagree is not because I think that Trump will somehow come around or Mitch McConnell will somehow change his mind. Well, the reason I think it's important is because I want the public to know. I think that it is important to shine a light on these problems,
yep,
these hypocrisies, these inconsistencies, in hopes that there's a cumulative effect for the electorate, that voters know, that the public knows, and that they can then use that information responsibly when they're able to cast a ballot, unless Republicans have rigged the election against them.
Well, and it's also a matter, too, of this ongoing debate that I think that you guys have on the Rachel Maddow Show, which is, what do we address? What do we focus on? Trump's words versus his deeds. And I kind of come down in the middle of that, in between, where I feel like, well, to an extent, both seem to me as if they're important to confront. Certainly his deeds rise to a higher level where you really have to focus on that more often. But I've even noticed that that Rachel does occasionally get into a couple of Trump's tweets, depending on how badly they resonate. So where do you specifically land on that balancing act between those two aspects of Trump's behavior?
That's a great question. I think that for me, and this is something we talk about on the show with some regularity, is that Trump is an unreliable narrator of his own presence.
Yeah.
You know, he will say things about how things are going and what he intends to do, and those words have no value. And so, you know, for example, if he were to announce today that he was going to pursue some policy agenda, we have no reason to believe that that's true. He may say it, and we may all hear it, but we are at a point with his presidency that where we know that Trump doesn't know and doesn't necessarily care what's actually going on around him. And so, when I hear his words about any subject, I take them to have effectively no predictive value. That said, I do take them seriously insofar as it lets me know about his priorities, about his values, about his efforts to divide America and see how he can pit Americans against one another. You know, it's not about using those words as a predictive value in terms of I don't think that he's telling the truth about what's going to happen, but I do think it's important to place. I see the significance of Trump using words to divide people and to generate an enraged base. There are consequences for that. And so I feel like I have a responsibility to not just ignore those.
Yeah, yeah. It's sometimes hard to know with Trump, especially with his tweets, especially with some of the crap that he says during his rallies, which we're going to be treated to for the first time in a while this weekend. But it's an ongoing debate that I have between whether Trump is deliberately trolling us or whether he's earnest in some of the crackpot things that he says. Because I feel like sometimes he really means the lie. Like, he's really trying to sell the lie. He wants you to believe the lie. Whereas other times the lie is there to just irritate us, to frustrate us. And so it's an ongoing, you know, kind of dividing rod process to find where he's being earnest and where he's just deliberately trying to jerk our chain. Do you see that too? Do you see that dichotomy with his approach to just blurting insane crap?
Sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, it's been a while since we've seen a rally, but all of the events that I've seen him hold, you know, for example, when he starts talking about fake news and, you know, he'll point in the back where the cameras are and he'll say that CNN's camera just went off when it hasn't. And, you know, I recognize, I think it's painfully obvious when he does that, that he's really just playing to the cameras. There's no real sincerity to this. He's not drawing attention to something that he considers important. Mm-hmm. It's catnip. He's throwing red meat at activists in the hopes that then they'll start chanting or they'll start applauding or, you know, giving him the praise that he's looking for. Mm-hmm. But it's hollow. It's meaningless. And so, you know, in instances like that, it's easier for me and people like me, I think, to just kind of, you know, roll their eyes and move on. But then there are other times when he uses rhetoric, as you noted a moment ago, he uses rhetoric at rallies that is far more pernicious and is far more alarming, that is much harder to just roll your eyes at. You know, I think that it's easy, if you listen to the president enough, that dichotomy comes into focus.
Yeah.
You start to tell the difference between obvious routine nonsense and things that have greater significance.
We'll get back to our conversation with Steve Bannon here in just one second. But before we do, let's talk about Plexiter, because we're all doing these Zoom meetings. We're all using FaceTime. And the thing that I noticed is every time I'm on FaceTime, I can see all of the weird things about my face. Zoom meetings with coworkers and clients, they're great until you notice those weird things, bags under your eyes and deep wrinkles. Let me tell you, these cameras pick up everything. But now imagine all that's gone. Without risky plastic surgery, just gone in a matter of minutes. I'm talking about Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under eye bags, all in the comfort of your own home. Plexiderm is the solution for your Zoom meeting face. I know, I tried it, I took the test, and I was amazed by the results. The best part is Plexiderm goes on clear and lasts for hours, so nobody's going to know that you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code for half off a full-size bottle of Plexiderm, plus an additional $10 off. That's half off plus an extra $10 off, or call 800-685-1292. Mention the code Voices. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit triplexiderm.com and use the code Voices. That's code Voices at triplexiderm.com.
The Bob Seska Show.
I'd love to get your take on this one. I've been debating with some friends about whether Trump's brand of politics is uniquely, quote-unquote, Trumpism, or if it's just the next iteration of Republicanism. How do you define Trumpism? Does it exist, and do you think it has a shelf life beyond all of this? Do you think it's going to continue to be a central component of the Republican Party moving forward?
Right. I think about this a lot, and there are certain variables that are still need to come into focus. You know, if Trump were to lose badly, hypothetically, in November, let's say Biden wins in a landslide.
Yeah.
I think that the incentive in Republican politics to move away from Trump and Trump's legacy will be more acute. So, you know, it will be, I think I can imagine, for example, a 1981 like environment for Democrats, where they were glad to see Carter go, and they made no real reference to Carter for a while. It was just no longer seen nor heard.
Yeah.
And so if Trump were to lose by that margin or something similar, I can imagine Mitch McConnell and others basically saying, Donald who? And then just kind of more or less wanting to, nothing more to do with him. But my only caveat to that is Trump's followers are really loyal to him more than the party.
Yes.
I think that they love him, not just his idea of this macho persona and not just his anti-immigration policies or the inherent racism that permeates his politics. I think that they're really invested in him personally. And so what I'll be curious to see, and at this point I really don't know, what I'll be curious to see is whether if Trump were to exit the stage, would his followers demand more of the party to be more like Trump? Would they expect Mitch McConnell and other and Kevin McCarthy and others to pick up Trump's mantle or to pick up an entirely new one? I don't yet know. I think it is easy to imagine Trumpism extending its life beyond Trump's presidency if his base and his followers demand it.
I want to ask you about working on the Rachel Maddow show. I've got lots of questions along these lines. I've been curious for years and years and years, especially when you made that transition from Washington Monthly over to Maddow Blog. What was that like going from Washington Monthly to a cable news network where you're continuing to blog and present your own point of view, but you're part of a much bigger machine? How did that process come together?
Well, that's a good question. I was blogging professionally full time for several years before Maddow reached out to me, and all of my background is in print media. You know, I first got out of grad school, I started working for a magazine, and so I had no background I didn't have any background in broadcast media, but you know, I love Rachel personally and professionally. Mm-hmm. I was a big fan of Rachel Maddow's show long before I started working there, and so I saw this as a great opportunity to expand my reach and to learn about broadcast media and to learn from Rachel Maddow every day, which is something that I take a great deal of pride in doing. And so it was a bit of a transition because it was a new dynamic for me. But at the same time, I every day I try to pause to appreciate the fact that I have the best job in the world. I get to write for Maddow Blog. I get to work with a great team. You know, I'm a producer in the show, but there are other producers, and I can't say enough great things about my colleagues. I get to talk to Rachel every day and help kind of shape the direction of the show sometimes. And it's incredibly rewarding. For your listeners, if you have a chance to work with Rachel Maddow, I highly recommend it.
I assure you that I think every single one of my listeners watches the Rachel Maddow show every night. I know I do. I mean, I got to tell you, that show has been such an oasis of truth and honesty and consistency. One of the things that I notice that is in common between you and Rachel, not only in terms of, generally speaking, your point of view, your worldview, but also the fact that you are so consistent. You both seem to have this almost juggernaut-like focus where I never see any sign of growing exhausted with the issues. I always feel like when I go to Maddow Blog, I'm getting a consistent, powerful, and always insightful point of view on what's going on. And that's across the board. So it seems like the match between your work and Rachel's work was very well connected.
Well, first, let me say about that. That's very kind of you to say, and I'm grateful for the praise. That means a lot to me, and I thank you. But to your question, yes, of course. I Rachel and I agree on effectively everything, and, mm-hmm. and we kind of have a similar vision of the world. We see the world through similar eyes. And so, right, when I joined the team, and I've had an opportunity to meet the other producers and get a sense of how they approach their responsibilities in the news, I see that we're really just kind of operating as one team, and we're all kind of on the same page. And I mean, there's certainly people on the staff who have different perspectives, and we're able to talk these things out, and we certain people recognize the importance of different issues in different ways. But we're all kind of rowing in the same boat in the same direction. And I think it didn't take long for me to realize that I was among a group of folks who made me feel very comfortable and who wanted to do the same kind of work that I did. And so, yeah, I felt very much at home, and I continue to feel very much at home. It's been eight and a half years now, believe it or not, since I joined Meadow's team. And it was the best decision I ever made. Well, professionally. Anyway. Marrying my wife was the best decision I ever made personally. Getting this job is the best for my professional life.
At the risk of sounding a little like Chris Matthews, I kind of have this fantasy that the Rachel Maddow staff, obviously including you, is kind of like XCOM during the Cuban Missile Crisis. In that respect, it's like a think tank made up of very, very smart people who are looking at new ways to examine an issue, to examine a crisis in some cases. And one of the most amazing things that you guys do there is coming up with a story or an argument or a point of view that many of us have never heard before. I've got my face pressed up against my computer screen 24/7 practically, and still, right, when I watch the Rachel Maddow show or I check out Maddow Blog, I'm seeing things that I hadn't seen before.
Yes. I'm writing a high volume of amount of blog content every day.
Yeah. Yes. I so appreciate the amount of output that you're responsible for on a daily basis. It is remarkable.
Well, thank you. That is my goal, is to produce a lot of content and hopefully content that people enjoy, and get something out of. There comes a point in the afternoon where I kind of scale back a little bit on the publishing and then organize my content for the show, for Rachel, kind of flagging things that I think are especially important, maybe some developments that happened over the course of the day that I haven't yet written about. And then I organize all of that into an email that I send around to Rachel and the team. We then meet usually around now, maybe an hour from now, and start going through the list, going through the day. Rachel is sensitive to the fact that by 9 p.m. Eastern, when our show airs on MSNBC, there's going to be a lot of news consumers who've already heard a lot of the news.
Yeah.
Maybe they listen to the radio on their way home from work, or mm-hmm. maybe they were reading that during the day. And so the idea of just telling folks news that they've already heard, very likely heard, that doesn't appeal to Rachel or to anyone on the team. And so the challenge is to come up with creative ways of telling people things that they haven't already heard throughout the course of the day. And so some days that will mean featuring stuff that I wrote about on the blog, some days not. But it's a collaborative process, to be sure. And we have an informal motto on the show. It's called increasing the amount of useful information in the world. That is the point of the Rachel Maddow show, is to increase the amount of useful information in the world. And we take the motto, that informal motto, seriously. And so when the show is coming together, it's not necessarily to pick the most important news of the day, but it's the most, the way it's about picking the news and stories that we feel like we can contribute to the most. And so that's kind of how the show comes together. I play a role insofar as I'm one of the producers, but it's a team effort. And in some days I have more influence than others, and that's fine because that's just the nature of the business. But I'm always glad to be able to contribute any way I can, of course.
One of the most unfair characterizations of the Rachel Maddow show is that it's a pundit show. That's a typical, it's like the MSNBC version of Tucker Carlson or the MSNBC version of whatever's happening on CNN. It's not. And I think that is so entirely inaccurate. And mostly I think that comes from people who have never actually watched the Rachel Maddow show. Is that a deliberate thing to separate that block from, I mean, more or less everything around it, not only across the other cable news channels, but also on MSNBC itself? There is nothing else on MSNBC that is like the Rachel Maddow show. Is that a deliberate endeavor, or is that something that just has evolved because of Rachel's personality and her worldview and so on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm reluctant to speak for Rachel because I can't. Rachel can speak for Rachel, and that's the way it should be. And so I am reluctant to kind of tell you more about her perspective because I'm not fully comfortable with that. I can tell you, though, that, you know, for me personally, I don't generally have a lot of time over the course of any given day to know what other shows and networks are doing because, mm-hmm. you know, I get so caught up in focusing on what we're going to be doing on the show and what I'm going to be writing about for the blog and just keeping up with the fire hose of news. It becomes challenging to start to even think about, well, what is network X going to do? What is host Y going to do? That just becomes time prohibitive, at least for me personally, that I can't possibly keep up with both the news and what other news shows are doing. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, focus really just on the news and what I can do to help report the news and how I can contribute to the show when we do the news. I don't think that there's a whole lot of thought into deliberate uniqueness, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. To your question about, you know, how deliberate is this? I don't think there's a whole lot of thought as to what other shows are doing. We want to focus really on what we're doing. And so,
yeah.
If we're doing something unique, I take that as a good sign. And so I'll interpret your question as praise.
Oh, it is absolutely praise. And in fact, the structure seems to me, looking in from the outside, that the main thrust of the show is information. Opinion is, right. You know, obviously part of it, but a much, much, much smaller part of it than essentially any other cable news show. It's all about the delivery of information that you haven't heard yet. And sometimes it's got Rachel's point of view. How could it not? But the information on the show is the central thrust. That's how it seems from the outside, at least.
Well, good. Yeah. I mean, like I was saying a moment ago, if the point of the show, that our guiding principle is increasing the amount of useful information in the world, and so and you as a viewer are taking away from that you know that you're getting valuable information, then we're succeeding. Then it means that we are doing exactly what we set out to do on any given show. Mm-hmm. So that is very good to hear, and I appreciate the support.
Well, and getting to your specific beat and the thrust of Maddow Blog, your coverage of the unemployment numbers, the GDP, the deficit/debt during the Obama recovery, so invaluable, especially to the rest of us who are in the trenches of the blogosphere and doing podcasts and so on. The reference material is immense. The charts you maintained, especially. Did you ever think you'd hit a month with unemployment numbers that dwarfed the numbers from the Great Recession?
No, it just seems so inconceivable to me after the Great Recession. I thought these are the worst numbers that I will see in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like a given that it would be impossible to see anything like this. And then to see when the latest, you know, job numbers from April, with, you know, 22 million jobs lost in a single month. I mean, it was, you know, I can't remember if I put this on the blog or if I just told Rachel this, but, you know, I was talking about, like, imagine I don't know if you're a baseball fan, but imagine someone, you know, the home run record is 60, then 61,
yeah.
And then steroid era becomes like close up to like 70. Imagine if someone came along in one season and hit 3,000 home runs. It would defy our understanding of reality. It's like there are numbers that we can expect. Those are extraordinary numbers, but then there are numbers that just boggle the mind, and we don't know what to do with that kind of information. And so, right, I look back at the Great Recession era, losing 700,000 jobs a month, 800,000 jobs a month.
Yeah.
You know, these were staggering. These were breathtaking numbers. But if you had told me at the time that we would see a month with 22 million job losses, I mean, I would have thought that was insane. I would have thought that was ridiculous. And it would seem as if it would require a meteor to hit a major city for something like that to happen.
Right.
And yet here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like having to add that to your chart, your unemployment numbers chart, would be almost right. Like when Rachel had to keep adding more screen space for all the people leaving the Trump administration. It seems like that same kind right. of endeavor. Like it keeps getting larger and larger, almost like the Star Destroyer at the beginning of Star Wars. Like, oh my God, it keeps going on and on and on. There was something that happened when the latest jobs numbers came out where BLS reported that they, I don't know if it was deliberate, but they kind of framed it as a mistake where they didn't count certain kinds of unemployment within those numbers. And they actually said there was an error in the reporting. And then after the latest number that came out, I think it was 13.3% unemployment.
Right.
There was then speculation that it was around 3 percentage points higher than it was. Should we take that seriously? Should we be revising upwards these numbers when we see them? Why was there the mistake? And is it something that we should even bother with?
It's an unusual time for the economy, and because we're dealing with unique set of circumstances that are just so, we haven't seen anything like this since 1918.
Yeah,
I'm sympathetic to Bureau of Labor Statistics and Labor Department statisticians in general, who are having to deal with what does unemployment mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like something that would be common sense to most people. If you know you don't have a job and you're unemployed, but when it comes to counting. For the purposes of these statistical analyses and the charts that I've been making, there are people who are not working or temporarily not working, who are prepared to reenter the workforce, but they're not necessarily looking for a job. There are all these nuances. And so as a result, we can look at the unemployment rate as 13.3 in a traditional sense. What the Labor Department came out and said is that, well, if we expand the definition, if we widen the aperture of the camera lens just a little bit to include some additional folks who are not working but want to and will probably eventually go back, that the unemployment rate is actually 3 percentage points higher. Mm-hmm. I would caution your listeners against thinking that there's a conspiracy. There is not.
Yeah.
You know, I remember Donald Trump in 2016 going around telling everyone that the job numbers were fake and that this was all phony. And that there's all a part of this elaborate scheme to confuse people or mislead people. That's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
What is the case is that it gets complicated to determine what the actual unemployment rate is, given the nuances that of people who are kind of on the edge. And so, you know, they came up with what some people call the correction, some call people call the clarification about what the actual unemployment rate is. In some respects, as important as these numbers are, of course, especially for people who are economically vulnerable, these nuances, they don't care about the labels. They care about whether they're going to put food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
But for the purposes of us who are kind of looking at the numbers in a raw sense, I think that we'll see some additional clarity in the coming months as the economy starts to adapt to these unusual circumstances. And so, I mean, I take at face value that the unemployment rate improved in May, at least in the technical sense. But I think you and I and most of your listeners would agree it's not improving nearly enough in terms of the actual health of the economy.
It's still 13.3%, which is horrendous.
And how many times have we seen numbers like that since the Great Depression? Never.
Right.
Like it was the worst month ever was April, and the second to worst was May. Since mm-hmm. the Great Depression, it's long before our lifetimes. I'm going to assume that we're the 7-6. You're not 100%.
No, I'm definitely not. No.
And so, you know, with that in mind, you know, there's no reason to assume any kind of behind the scenes chicanery here. But I do. What we can assume is that we're dealing with such unusual circumstances that the usual way of looking at numbers doesn't always tell us everything we need to know.
And, you know, there's something else I wanted to ask you about. I've been dying to ask someone, anyone from the show about this. Speaking
Please,
of
fairly.
Behind the scenes chicanery, specifically at the Department of Justice, what was it like around the Rachel Maddow Show offices when the Mueller report dropped? I remember being excited to finally have the document in hand. But you know what? To be perfectly honest, I felt a little let down that it was that the scope of Mueller's investigation was in the end so limited, especially given the roster of news stories that had preceded it. Did you guys have a similar reaction? What was the frame of mind leading up to the Mueller report's release, you know, with the Bill Barr letter and everything like that? And then what was it like afterwards, just in terms of your personal reactions? How did you feel about the upshot of the Mueller report?
Well, you know, for me personally, when I was going through it the day that it came down, I think one of the things that jumped out at me was the extent to which the investigation was obstructed. You know, he pointed to, the Mueller and his team pointed to all kinds of areas of wrongdoing, instances in which the president lied, instances in which the president tried to exert unnecessary influence over the process. But it was the obstruction, I think, that stood out for me first and foremost as the most problematic thing that Mueller was pointing out. Because I think your point as to the kind of the letdown, many of us were looking for a Mueller report that was going to blow the doors off the White House, and that obviously didn't happen. But at the same time, when I was reading the document, and I started to take stock of all of the things that the president did to undermine the investigation, I think put that report in context, because we were really only getting a part of the picture, and because the president only wanted us to have part of the picture, and he went out of his way to make sure that we didn't get the full picture. So I will tell you, by the way, just as a trivia moment, a point of personal privilege, I was not in the room with Rachel and the team when the report came out. I was working remotely,
okay.
So I can't actually tell you what the attitude was like in the atmosphere was like in the room. I wasn't there. But having said that, I can speak for myself. When I was reading it while working remotely, that was the thing that came to my mind the most was just how much effort the president and his team took and the effort that they made to make sure that investigation was derailed as best that they could. And I think that in itself was important, because if there was no wrongdoing and there was no scandal, then why would the president be so eager to undermine and obstruct an investigation into what he considers to be nothing, or what he pretends to have been nothing? So that was my general take. What was your general take when the Mueller report came out?
I guess generally I was satisfied with what was there, what they presented in each of those two volumes. But at the same time, I thought that there was going to be broader allegations, money laundering, certainly some additional indictments along the way, if for no other reason, perjury. But I think to an extent we are all kind of subject to the chicanery that was going on with the Barr letter that came out, whatever it was, 3 weeks, 4 weeks before the Mueller report ever actually dropped. So in that respect, Bill Barr kind of sucked all the air out of the room.
I think that makes sense. And I thought it was interesting a moment ago you referenced what could happen after Trump leaves office.
Yeah.
You know, I put this on the blog a couple of times, so regular readers would be familiar with the idea, but, you know, statute of limitations matter.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that Donald Trump needs to be concerned about in the event that if he were to lose in November 2020. I'm not making any predictions. I don't know what would happen. I don't know what kind of interest there would be in the part of law enforcement, but there are things that he did throughout his first term that leave him with some vulnerabilities, let's say. And so it's interesting to think about what could happen to the president in terms of the legal liabilities in the event of his defeat, and in the event that if he has a second term, what would that mean for the statute of limitations? I find those issues and those questions to be fascinating.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I tracked down an OLC memo from, I want to say, 01 or 02, in which the OLC at Justice basically outlined that the president can, in fact, be indicted for crimes that he was impeached for. And it doesn't matter if he's acquitted in the Senate, he can still be indicted for those crimes. So I'm encouraged by that, at the very least. But, you know, I wanted to ask you, too, did we ever find out what happened with the counterintelligence investigation? Have we ever received a sufficient explanation as to what it was? Did they not find anything and just dropped it? What happened with that?
You don't mean the Senate intelligence, do you?
There was a counterintelligence investigation that seemed to be underway. I know Rachel must have asked Adam Schiff about that a million times with regard to Trump and Russia and any sort of way that Trump might have been compromised by Russia. I felt that that was maybe the central thrust of whatever it was. But we heard a lot about a counterintelligence investigation, quote unquote. And it seems like we never reached a conclusion to that.
I think you're right. I think that those are I hesitate to say that the investigation is still ongoing because I find it hard to imagine that possibility, mm-hmm. especially given the president's influence over the intelligence agencies right now.
Yeah.
But you're right. There are those lingering questions that have never fully been satisfactorily answered by the relevant investigators. And so, you know, I'm glad to see that we've gotten a lot of answers from people, from entities like the Senate Intelligence Committee. I'm glad to see that we've gotten some information from the House Intelligence Committee. Certainly the Mueller investigation helped kind of shape our understanding of these related issues. But yes, to your point, yes, the counterintelligence investigation that has been discussed and considered has never really put together a report that kind of captures this information for the public, at least not yet.
How are you feeling about Election Day, Steve?
Well, I take note of the polls, if for no other reason that it offers a sense of direction. You know, if I look at polling in June 2020, and it's telling me that the average roughly is in the ballpark of 8 points for a Biden lead, mm-hmm. and then I revisit polling in late September and I see him with a number that's significantly different from 8, well, I want to have that point of comparison.
Oh, yeah. Great. Great point. Yeah, yeah.
A sense of direction. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that Biden fans should be elated now or disheartened in September, but it's just getting a sense of where is the electorate at this point in time. That's why I pay attention to polling. But I think part of the challenge is that we're dealing with such unusual circumstances between the pandemic, the economic effects of the pandemic, social justice protests. We don't yet know what the political landscape will look like in November. I mean, think about how far away November is as compared to that amount of time in our recent past. Could I have predicted in February where we would be in June? Well, no, I couldn't have. That would have been impossible. If you had told me in February what June would be like, I would have thought that was absurd. And so that's why I approach these predictions with some humility. That said, the political scientist in me looks at the available information and says that Biden has to be seen as the front runner for the 2020 presidential election. Mm-hmm. He is well positioned, and given his advantage, which is unusual for a challenger, it would not surprise me if he were to win. I think that the odds are in his favor. Having said that, 2020 is a strange and ridiculous time. So,
understatement.
And so with that in mind, I think that Republicans who see Biden's lead and are heartbroken, or Democrats who are looking at Biden's lead and elated, all of them should keep those emotions in check, because a lot is likely to happen between now and November, and anyone who can say with confidence exactly what's going to happen is fooling themselves.
Well, the book is called The Imposters: How Republicans Quit Governing and Seized American Politics. Again, link in the description at bobseska.com. This book is required reading. Thank you so much for taking the time out to talk with me today, Steve.
Bob, you're incredibly kind and generous. I appreciate it very much, and I hope that we can talk again soon.
You bet. Take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Hold it. Don't go anywhere. Now more than ever, we're all thinking about our hygiene. We're washing our hands, sneezing into our arms, trying not to touch our faces, but it's hard to resist. What about your cell phone, though? It's a gigantic carrier of germs, even though it's teeny tiny. Phones are a vector for disease, and we rarely ever clean them. We're constantly touching our phones with our hands and even pressing them to our face. It's time to take cleaning your phone seriously. The Clean Phone Pro Sanitizer uses medically proven UV light technology to kill 99.99% of all the bacteria that comes in contact with your phone. Better than wipes and safe for your device, the Clean Phone Pro gets every inch of your phone clean with 9 high-power UVC lights. There's a dedicated wireless charging pad on top of the chamber. You can be sanitizing your other items while wirelessly charging your phone, or you can just use Clean Phone Pro as your go-to charging station anytime. And by the way, the Clean Phone Pro is also selling N95 masks. So if you need masks, and everyone should, go to thecleanphone.com today and buy your N95 masks, as well as the Clean Phone Pro, of course, for just $89 in free shipping when you use the code SEXYLIBERAL, all one word. If you're serious about hygiene, it's time to get serious about cleaning your phone. Go to thecleanphone.com and keep your phone truly clean. Remember to use the code SEXYLIBERAL, all one word, for 2-day free shipping, and don't sweat it. It's going to ship immediately. That's thecleanphone.com, thecleanphone.com.